This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The magazine, once considered the voice of the counterculture, has more recently been called the Wall Street Journal of Rock and Roll. My guest Robert Draper has written a history of Rolling Stone magazine and how its changes reflect changes in the generation that the magazine was first written by and for, changes in rock music and magazine publishing, and changes in the life of the founding editor, Jan Wenner. Rolling Stone has been published every 2 weeks since 1967. Draper writes, by the end of the 60s, Rolling Stone was accepted as the authoritative rock and roll magazine. By 1971, Rolling Stone was what Esquire had been in the 60s, the breeding ground of explosive new journalists. 2 years later, the magazine began to make money. 3 years after that, it helped elect a president. By 1989, Rolling Stone's parent company, Straight Arrow Publishers Incorporated, was worth perhaps $250 million, over 30,000 times its value 22 years before. I asked Draper about the personal importance of the magazine in his life.
It was a publication that understood the thing that counted most to me and to my friends, rock and roll. If it understood rock and roll, then I could trust it to speak with authority on other issues as well. I probably began reading the magazine around 1970 or so. I remember letting my subscription expire in the early 80s, and at the time I wasn't really sure why. I suppose I just felt that the magazine had grown away from me or me away from it. It was in my investigation of the magazine that I began to realize that, in fact, the magazine had made a number of marketing adjustments consciously designed to alienate its original readership. So on that level, looking into the magazine's history was an opportunity for self-discovery, I suppose.
So you were a less interesting demographic later on in the magazine's history.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
What was the original identity of Rolling Stone as a music magazine? How did Rolling Stone's music coverage compare to the other rock magazines of the time?
Well, it was certainly more authoritative. From the outset, Rolling Stone attempted to do something that no other magazine had, which was simply cover the music scene with a certain solemnity, but sprinkled with a certain amount of humor. At the time, there were a few other publications, most prominently Crawdaddy, that were surveying the music scene and reviewing records. But frequently, they either tended to be trivial or tended to be reverential. Rolling Stone was neither. Rolling Stone covered rock and roll in much the same way that Time magazine would cover the Vietnam War. At the same time, I should add that Rolling Stone was always disdainful of objectivity, and so you would not find in its pages a sort of solemn impartiality. Rather, the magazine rejoiced in slamming things and pedestalizing things when they felt that was called for.
Can you give us a little capsule of what Jan Wenner was like when he founded the magazine?
Yeah, at the time, Jan Wenner was out of work. Jan was a 21-year-old Berkeley dropout who entertained no particular ambitions. He had been a very talented young man, but was not entirely certain how to channel his talents. It seemed that more than anything else, what had driven Jan was a desire to be, as I say in the book, in the company of greatness. Jan himself was never certain what that meant, but whatever fascinated him, wherever the action was, that's where Jan wanted to be. At the time, music was where the action was, and Jan was a diehard rock and roll fan. To Jan's credit, I should say that a number of people who I'd interviewed from the outset had led me to believe that Jan never understood rock and roll, and that's most certainly not the case. In fact, in 65 and 66, there was probably no one in America covering the San Francisco scene with the comprehensiveness and the authority that Jan Wenner was. So Jan brought that to Rolling Stone. At the same time, I don't think that it was in the cards, or at least in Jan's mind, to create a magazine that would become the New Yorker of his generation. He was heard to tell people that he created Rolling Stone so that, quote, I can meet John Lennon, unquote. And I certainly think that there was an element of that. People from the outset were calling Jan the original fan or the ultimate groupie. And so his yearnings to meet people and to be where the action was propelled him throughout the first years and, of course, to this day.
Robert Draper is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, which is called Rolling Stone Magazine, The Uncensored History. Obviously, one of the strengths of Rolling Stone early on was its music coverage. It had some terrific writers like Greil Marcus, Lester Bangs, Ed Ward. Let's look a moment at some of like the more outstanding moments of the magazine's music coverage, in addition to the reviews This was a little later on in the magazine's history. It covered the Altamont Festival, mm-hmm. and it covered it differently than the mainstream press did. Describe a little bit what was special about Rolling Stone's coverage of Altamont.
Well, for one thing, Rolling Stone, like all other magazines in America, had swallowed the Woodstock myth, hook, line, and sinker. Rolling Stone, however, was probably the first to disgorge the myth. Others, such as Time magazine, were prepared to cover Altamont as if it were a quote-unquote Woodstock West. Rolling Stone saw through that. Of course, Rolling Stone had a number of people there at Altamont that day and had seen the horrors perpetrated by the Hell's Angels. It was clear in the minds of the people who were there to cover the event from Rolling Stone, Greil Marcus, John Morthland, Lester Bangs, Langdon Winter, and others, that Altamont was not only not a Woodstock, but probably ended for all time any notion of a Woodstock myth. Now, it was not their ambition to cover Altamont after that. They simply wanted it to go away. It was Ralph Gleason who first persuaded Jan Winter to go after Altamont full tilt, and Jan in turn who persuaded his troops, indeed ordered them, to not only cover Altamont completely, but to assess the blame, which in fact the magazine did. John Burks at the time was managing editor, and he sent out reporters to interview virtually everyone who had anything on any level to do with Altamont, and put together a piece that you wouldn't find in today's periodicals. It was a disorganized piece. It sort of had a caterwauling flavor to it, but nonetheless was enormously thorough and covering every aspect of the concert and explaining exactly what went wrong and leaving no doubt in the reader's mind but that this was an event that could not in any way be confused with the Woodstock myth and, in fact, would end that myth for all time.
So in a lot of ways, this Rolling Stone edition on Altamont really changed the way Americans viewed the event.
Yeah, I think so, and the National Magazine Award certainly thought so because they awarded Rolling Stone a National Magazine Award in part for its Altamont coverage.
Let's look at some of the weaknesses of Rolling Stone's coverage of music. You write a lot about how reviews of records have often been influenced by the whims of the editor and publisher, Jan mm-hmm. Winter. Even early on, he tried to often control whether a review was positive or negative. Some examples
right.
of that?
Yeah, sure. Among the people who were sort of sacrosanct at the very beginning were the Beatles, Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. Jan was always very, very vigilant regarding how or to what degree those individuals would be criticized. Bob Dylan, in particular, was exempted from any type of real critical scrutiny until, I believe, 1970, when Greil Marcus wrote something unfavorable about Dylan. He was subsequently fired. Not only in the early years, but in later years, Jan would always reserve the right to reassign reviews when their opinions were different than his. And typically, this would be when their opinions resulted in castigating someone who was a friend of Jan's. In fact, I think I quote one individual who says it's always a risk to rate too low someone that Jan has had lunch with. Jan has always reserved that editorial right. Unfortunately, that sort of sells short the credibility of the publication in terms of its music criticism.
There was a writer's protest in 1970. What were some of the issues at Rolling Stone that the writers were up in arms about?
Well, what was going on then was Kent State, People's Park, and a number of other very severe clashes between the establishment and the left. And this inflamed politically a number of people at Rolling Stone who had been involved in campus politics at Berkeley. Jan had always had a wavering commitment to the left. Ultimately, Rolling Stone was Jan's magazine, not the left's magazine, and Jan had demonstrated that on a number of occasions. But in 1970, when it looked like all hell was breaking loose on campuses, Rolling Stone's staff set out to do an issue, a Kent State issue, that would essentially advocate revolutionary means to overthrow the establishment. While this was going on, Jan was touring around New York and Chicago gathering advertisers and did not know that this issue was taking place. When he found out about it, he was extremely upset and essentially purged the staff of those who were involved. At the time, and this would happen throughout Rolling Stone's history, people who worked at Rolling Stone forgot essentially whose magazine it was. Since Jan was not involved in the day-to-day running of things, they often felt that the magazine was theirs, or at the very least, managing editor John Burks's. And they looked at Jan as nothing more than a hindrance. As John Carroll would say, he had it wrong. He said, "I thought our mission was to save the world." In fact, Rolling Stone had no mission. It was always what Jan Winter wanted it to be. And they drew up a list of principles to be affirmed when Jan returned from New York and Chicago, basically demanding more editorial control, demanding that Jan stay out of reviews, and a number of other things which Jan found unpalatable, as a result of which he discharged a number of members of his staff.
One of the things that makes it interesting to follow the history of Rolling Stone magazine is watching how a magazine that was written by members of a generation, for members of a generation, changed as the writers got older, and changed as rock and roll changed. Mm-hmm. Was there something of a music crisis for the writers at Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I think there was. I mean, the crisis was primarily that of age. I mean, there began to be a generation gap. Rolling Stone's music critics by the mid-70s had reached their 30s and weren't paying nearly as much attention to whatever the cutting edge happened to be, intended to promote the same guys they'd been promoting since the late 60s. This was especially seen, or perhaps first seen, with the advent of disco, something that Rolling Stone staffers never understood and which, in Greil Marcus's words, we simply wished would go away. It was also seen with the beginnings of punk rock. There were a few new members that Rolling Stone had hired, especially the Reverend Charles M. Young, who had been great advocates of punk rock. There were a number of others, however, who found the that genre of music distasteful. Among these was certainly Jan Winter. It has been noted that Jan's taste in music probably has been informed by events that ended by 1973 or so, and Jan himself confesses to not having listened to, for example, Elvis Costello or the Sex Pistols. And so when this music would come around, Jan tended, as others did, to dig in his heels and insist that it was not worthy of attention, that it was simply sort of an anti-movement more than anything else. What this resulted in was Rolling Stone slowly ceding its position as the authoritative journal of record regarding rock and roll, and left others such as MTV an opening to come in and seize the crown.
Rolling Stone started as a music magazine, and then it became known as well for its political coverage. Why did politics take a more important place than it once had in the magazine? What was that representative of?
Well, it was representative of nothing more than Jan Winter's interests. I mean, at bottom, Rolling Stone has always been a window into Jan's yearnings, fantasies, and interests. And by this time, Jan was developing an interest in various politicians and political movements. It's probably closer to the mark to say that Jan has always been more interested in politicians than in politics itself. But at that time, after the 1972 political coverage, Jan was beginning to recognize that Rolling Stone could be a player in politics. He began to be courted by politicians, and this charmed Jan. So as a result, he began to hire out more and more people who would do political writing for them.
Let's look at the story of advertising in Rolling Stone, which I think really shows a lot, not only about how Rolling Stone changed, but how many things changed between the 60s and the 80s. Initially, because Rolling Stone was perceived as such the mouthpiece of the counterculture, and because it was a music magazine, just about all the ads were record company magazines, record company ads. And when Rolling Stone tried to branch out into other product advertising, they were turned down a lot.
Mm-hmm. They were. Rolling Stone was regarded by Madison Avenue as nothing more than a hippie publication, and this was especially seen in Jan's courting of Volkswagen. When Jan was seeking to wrest himself away from the dependence that he had on the music industry for ad revenues, he began to follow around Volkswagen representatives, trying to sell them on the virtues of Rolling Stone. It simply didn't take. Volkswagen was convinced, and partly because of the manner in which Jan would attempt to sell them on it, a sort of scattershot method that was very emblematic of Rolling Stone itself. Volkswagen was convinced that Rolling Stone would never amount to more than an anti-establishment publication. publication. Rolling Stone had a curious, it is sort of an interesting sub-history to see how Rolling Stone changed in its advertising department. Its original advertising rate cards said right on them in sort of solemn tones that that they would not accept advertisements from cosmetics companies and from the military. And each piece of ground that was given regarding who they would sell ads to and who they wouldn't sell ads to always came as a result of very, very heated debate, particularly whether or not to sell ads to the military, something that finally by the early 80s Rolling Stone was doing. And, of course, to this day, I think the current issue on the stands has a be-all-you-can-be ad in it. But that, of course, would have been unfathomable back in the late 60s while Vietnam was going on. And even things that now would seem almost laughable today, like whether or not to include liquor ads, were subject to enormously heated debate. And finally, ground was given in the mid-70s, I believe, when Joe Armstrong was publisher.
In 1985, Rolling Stone had a campaign geared toward advertisers to try to change the advertiser's image of the magazine. It was the Perception versus Reality campaign. Mm-hmm. Would you describe it?
Yeah, it was a generally speaking, a two-page ad. On the first page would be a picture of something that was emblematic of the hippie days, a peace symbol, a Volkswagen van, a long-haired hippie, and above that would be the word perception. On the second page, the facing page, would be the bold-faced word reality, and beneath that, something that would be emblematic of today's yuppie, where there would be a long-haired hippie on one page, there would be a very Tony-looking yuppie on the other. The intent being to show potential advertisers that Rolling Stone's reader had changed a great deal. It was a very, very clever campaign. At times, it was a fairly harsh campaign as well, because as Harriet Fear suggested, made all of that grist for the mill, made the 60s look like something that we could all sneer at. It was not simply suggesting that Rolling Stone's readers had changed. It was drawing up caricatures of what the readers had been like before, caricatures that were fairly mocking and downright cold.
Did it work? In terms of getting new advertisers?
Unquestionably, it worked. And I don't have the numbers in front of me to quantify it, but their ad revenues changed almost overnight. To this day, Rolling Stone runs Perception Reality ads, and indeed, Jan's other magazine, Us Magazine, uses Fal McGillicutt Rice with a similar campaign pitting Us Magazine against its rival People Magazine. There's no question but that the Perception Reality campaign not only worked, but was admired throughout the industry. And as I say, it was an enormously clever campaign and played very effectively on well-worn images.
Did the campaign alienate either readers of Rolling Stone or its own writers?
It's difficult to say whether it alienated readers. There doesn't appear to be any evidence that its current readership was mortally offended by those. And of course, its current readership probably hasn't even seen a lot of those. They appeared mainly in trade magazines. Certainly, its writers were upset. When I interviewed people on the 23rd floor over at Rolling Stone, virtually everyone was embarrassed by the campaign and wanted to assure me that Rolling Stone was not, as they put it, about that campaign, and that this sort of thing was taking place, if not over their howling objections, then at least over their discontent. At the same time, it was a battle, as far as the editorial people were concerned, that just wasn't worth fighting. It was clear that Jan loved the campaign, and these days at Rolling Stone, when you fight battles like that, you're just going to lose.
Another direction the magazine took in the 1980s was its marketing through music. Explain what that was.
Marketing through music was a newsletter put out by the Rolling Stone's business department. It did not actually say Rolling Stone magazine on it except at the very bottom, but it was clearly a Rolling Stone-sponsored newsletter that intended to promote corporate sponsorship of rock and roll. The newsletter would be about 8 pages or so and would have a number of articles in it suggesting effective campaigns that certain businesses had used with various musicians as their actors or sponsors or whatever. And there would even be a column in the Marketing Through Music newsletter suggesting various ways that companies out there could exploit music for its own purposes. Again, this was an area that made the editorial folks on the 23rd floor rather ashamed. They had always indicated that there was no relationship, as far as they could tell, between what was put out in the magazine and marketing through music, and they wished that it would go away. Ultimately, it did. But what it did in the meantime was prevent Rolling Stone from taking a very hard stance on the corporate sponsorship of rock and roll, a fairly controversial topic, and there are intelligent arguments to be made on either side. Rolling Stone wouldn't take a side because it had essentially recused itself from the debate. After all, Rolling Stone was the official sponsor, in a way, of corporate sponsorship with its marketing through music newsletter. So that was an area in which Rolling Stone could have taken a very firm and influential stance, but could not.
What do you think of the state of the magazine today? I'm sure you've been reading it, if for no other reason than to do research for your book.
Well, I think that the magazine still consistently runs excellent articles, and frequently on subjects that no other people could touch. Rolling Stone has not sold out. It has not betrayed a particular stance. And indeed, Rolling Stone never had a stance to sell out, which was always the beauty of the magazine: its flexibility and its ability to find positions between other extreme positions. What it has betrayed is not so much a principle, but its own excellence, and it does that on a biweekly basis. I mean, people these days. A number of people from its former readership will look at Rolling Stone disdainfully as the magazine that puts Bon Jovi on the cover. And in not picking up that Bon Jovi issue, they will have missed an excellent article by Lewis Cole on crack. By sneering at the magazine that now puts Don Johnson on its cover, they will have missed David Black's award-winning article about AIDS. And that's a shame, and that's a betrayal unto itself.
Robert Draper, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Draper is the author of Rolling Stone magazine, The Uncensored History. Jan Wenner declined an invitation to speak on Fresh Air in response to Draper's criticisms, but through a spokesperson, Wenner said yes, he's had an influence, but no more than any other editor at any other magazine, and never so much as to compromise the integrity of Rolling Stone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.